Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. I'm your host, Big John. And for this episode of The Big Questions, we explore issues of liberty, markets, and morality with a thinker who is reshaping how we view freedom and fairness. He's a professor at the University of San Diego, where he founded the Center for Ethics, Economics, and Public Policy, blending philosophy with real-world impact. So this is not one of those guys that's all head up in the clouds. He's also got his feet on the ground, so that's going to be a good conversation. He's got some books that you may have heard of, The Individualist, Universal Basic Income, What Everyone Needs to Know, and many others. He unpacks the evolution of libertarianism, the case for UBI, and, you know, issues that sometimes libertarians are not comfortable with, like exploitation, with a journey that started with Ayn Rand, like many libertarians. But he's led a path towards nuanced, bleeding heart libertarianism. That's not a phrase you often hear. He's here to change our assumptions and challenge some of our orthodoxy about libertarianism. Everyone, please welcome Professor Matt Zwolinski. Professor, how are you today?
I'm doing great, John, and really happy to be here talking with you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I always love to talk to people who are willing. I love talking to professors because they're used to dealing with people like myself who have a lot of questions. Let's face it, not too much going on up here. So it's always good to have someone who can explain. That's why I think I was drawn to Milton Friedman in my youth, because I found that he was a great teacher, not just a brilliant man, but a brilliant man who could communicate his brilliance, which I think is a rare quality for someone to possess. So let's start at the beginning. Where were you born? What was your childhood like?
Oh gosh, my wife's a psychologist. You're giving me flashbacks here to being on the couch. I'm a California native. I'm in San Diego right now, and I was born in California, but on the other end of the state. I was born up in the Bay Area, in the mid 1970s, and grew up there. Went to college there at Santa Clara University. During the 90s, so right when Silicon Valley was really taking off, all of my friends were dropping out of college and making six-figure salaries working for little startups like Google and Apple. And really my kind of intellectual journey started taking off in college. In high school, I wasn't political in any sense. I didn't even know what philosophy was a thing when I was in high school. I thought that was something that existed back in ancient Greece, but we were sort of done with it now. So it never would have even occurred to me that philosophy was a possible career option for somebody. But when I got to college, it was a Catholic college. Santa Clara University is a Jesuit university. And so philosophy is part of the required curriculum there. So I was
fellow Jesuit educated person right here. I went to Fordham, so I understand. Oh, I understand the curriculum. There you go.
That's cool. Then, thus your lifelong curiosity, I suppose. That was great. I love the education I got there, and I love the fact that I was forced to take something that I wouldn't have taken otherwise, to just really open up a whole new world of ideas and possibilities to me. So that's where I discovered my love of philosophy in the classroom. My introduction to political philosophy and libertarianism also came at Santa Clara University, but not in the classroom. That was sort of extracurricular. I had a friend I don't even remember how I met this guy, but one day I remember he handed me this copy of this big fat book called The Fountainhead and said, "You really got to read this." So I did, and it changed my life. I fell in love with the ideas of Ayn Rand and just went down this very deep rabbit hole of exploring those ideas. I started an Objectivist Club on campus, and I decided that I didn't want to go to law school anymore. Instead, I wanted to go to graduate school and get a PhD in philosophy. So
we have Ayn Rand to thank for one less lawyer in the world.
We do, yes. Okay. We'll add that to our list of many accomplishments.
So that's a good thing. You know, and it's interesting, your sort of collegiate journey into libertarianism, because I find in interviewing a lot of folks about their formative introductions into libertarianism, I find your story to be a common one, right? So you have the story where someone went to school or college and said, oh, you know, I was studying X, but a friend handed me this pamphlet, or a friend invited me to a meeting about libertarianism or anarchy or something to that effect, and then that put them on the path, as opposed to formal instruction, which kind of follows, right? Because typically American campuses, I would say for at least, and from your timeline, you're about half a generation younger than I am. So I would think this would apply to you as well. From my experience, college campuses have always been more leftist leaning in terms of their political ideologies, to the extent that even when you ask kids today, what economists have you heard? You know, very few of them have heard of Austrian economists or studied Austrian economists. They're all Keynesians of nature for the most part. And philosophically, you don't hear too much about Rand or Locke or any of those folks that might put you on the path formally to study libertarianism and individualism, right? Do you still feel that's the case on campuses?
That's still overwhelmingly true. There are a lot more libertarian faculty now in the United States in philosophy departments, in economics departments. But when I say a lot more, I'm talking about maybe, you know, like tripling or quadrupling the number like 20, which is right. What it was maybe when I was in college. It's probably more than that, actually. The growth has been pretty remarkable, thanks to organizations like the Institute for Humane Studies, which you know, people outside of academia might not have heard of, but it's an organization that has been around since I was in college, you know, at least, identifying people with an interest in classical liberal libertarian ideas who might want to pursue an academic career, and then kind of helping them through the pipeline. And it's been tremendously successful, I think. So those ideas are a lot more common in academia now than they were in my day, but still, for the average college student, you know, if you're going through your undergraduate experience, you're probably not going to read Hayek, right? You're almost certainly not going to read Rand or Rothbard, even if you major in economics or philosophy. And I think economics and philosophy are probably two of the more ideologically diverse fields, right, on college campuses. You know, if you go to an English department or a history department, the chances are that it's going to be populated by 100% left-wing faculty members.
Right. And I feel like I should invite you on one of my other podcasts to discuss that issue specifically, because I think that I'm tempted to go down that rabbit hole, but it would draw away from what I want to do, which is talk to you about your career and your works. But definitely, I remember being, at the time, a young, say, Goldwater conservative, I would have described myself during my college years, and just the immense disdain that I was met with from my professors, who you would think would be, all right, I don't agree with this kid, but let me at least try to educate him, you know? Right. And it was more just like, get out of my class. And I could still sense that on a lot of college campuses via my nieces and nephews and just friends of children of friends, college age kids of friends, you know, when we talk about this. I want to sort of transition into something so you're in college, you're introduced to libertarianism, you're introduced to objectivism with Rand. Did that sort of immediately put you on the path, like, let me study this philosophy of liberty, of the individual, as opposed to what might be considered collectivist theories? Or did that sort of simmer in the background as you progress towards the typical, I don't want to say indoctrination as a pejorative, but you understand what I mean, like the typical course of study, say, at a Jesuit university?
Yeah, no, I went in pretty hard, pretty fast.
Okay.
When I first discovered Ayn Rand. So, you know, the person who gave me the book was also very into Rand's philosophy and had a little sort of informal study group that he was a part of. So he invited me into that. And so, you know, I would go to these study group sessions and we would read some of the, you know, philosophical works, as well as the fiction, you know, and not just the political stuff, but we would get into, you know, the objectivist epistemology and so forth. I then started a club on campus that would bring in speakers. We had Andrew Bernstein from the Ayn Rand Institute come and talk about abortion on a Catholic campus, which was upset a few people. I was doing, you know, study sessions online. We had like, well, not online, really. It was like a phone group, right, that we would do study
sessions. A conference call. Yeah.
Conference calls, right? Dating myself here on Leonard Peikoff's book. So I was hardcore into it. And the politics were a big part of it for me. Like I was intrigued by her political theories, but I think the thing that really got me about Rand was it was the first time in my life that I had encountered really a systematic philosophy, right? That, I mean, besides Catholicism, which I grew up with, right? But a secular systematic philosophy that had an account of like everything, right? That had an account of ethics, of metaphysics, of epistemology, of art, and that tied it all together. So it was a way for me who was just beginning to kind of explore the world of ideas of having this, I felt like I had a map, right? That took this complex, messy reality and simplified it in a way that allowed it to make sense for me. And so the politics were part of that, but it was just a part, right? It was just a piece of this bigger puzzle. And what really attracted me to it, I think, was just the systematicity of it, the seeming rigor of it, right? Like there was a kind of attempt, at least, to logically piece together all these different complex aspects of reality. And that was incredibly exciting for me.
Yeah, and you know, my own experience with Rand, I have to say, not that I can, and I always have trouble formulating this, but I always felt uneasy with her objectivism. I can't explain why, in a way that would make sense to a logician, you know. While I was perfectly comfortable with her economic positions, you know, and if you know, watching her on Donahue or watching, like an interview with Mike Wallace, I think from the late 50s or something like that, her economic positions I was very comfortable with. But this, and I don't know if it's my, and I'll steal from you, my bleeding heart libertarianism, but just felt uncomfortable with what appeared to be not just a selfish nature, but a selfish nature that didn't care about being selfish. And I don't know, that always made me uneasy to me. I mean, I don't begrudge anyone who found it inspiring or gave them purpose in life, nor did I view it as bad or evil, but I just felt uncomfortable embracing it. Can you explain to me why I would feel that way?
No, I mean, I think that's a perfectly natural reaction. I think, and look, when Rand described herself as an egoist, when she had a philosophical view there that she was seriously committed to, but I think there's also a part of her that liked tweaking people's noses a bit, right? And say, like, here's this word that you all are going to have this immediate negative reaction to, but I want to convince you that it's actually something good. It's actually something that you should embrace. I think she's had more than a little bit of contrarianness to her.
Right.
So I think that was not unappealing. But I mean, she, you know, on the objectivist ethics, right, there's kind of a complicated story about what exactly egoism means. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you never help anybody else or you never care about anybody else's well-being. The thought is that, at least in some cases, maybe a lot of cases, caring about other people is valuable, and it's in your self-interest, right? You're gonna live a bad life if you don't care about other people. So there's an attempt there to synthesize these two seeming opposites of self-interest and concern for others. You know, altruism is a term she reserved for a particular kind of what you might call pathological care about others, one that elevates others above the self. And even in, like, a non-objectivist can see instances of that kind of thing, right? Where you have people that are so invested in other people that they neglect the care of their own psychological well-being or even physical well-being sometimes, right? We look at that kind of phenomenon and we say, like, there's something's gone wrong with that person. So there's, you know, I'm not an objectivist anymore. I think there's a lot of problems in Rand's philosophy. But there's something there, right? Like there's more to be said for most of her positions, I think, than many of her detractors give her credit for.
Yeah. And like I said, I think it's a complicated thing. And at the end of the day, to steal from the kids, it's a feels situation with me, with her, you know, it's, like, I always wondered, I don't know if anybody actually posed this question to her. How would she feel, say, about a mother, like the classic movie situation, a mother in childbirth, given the choice of sacrificing her life or her soon to be born child's life? The woman who chooses the child over herself, how would she view that? Is that the worst case of altruism? Is that a case of genetic altruism? I don't know if she was ever posed with that, but in my mind, that's like an interesting hypothetical for her objectivism.
Yeah, I'm sure she was posed with that question. And if I was a better Rand aficionado, I would probably be able to recite to you the precise answer that she gave. And I'm sure she would say it with absolute confidence, as though it was clearly and obviously the only correct answer in that situation. Which is one of the things that eventually came to trouble me about Rand. And as I said, you know, what attracted to me to that philosophy in the first place was the systematicity of it, the way in which it seemed to provide this roadmap to the world. One of the things that eventually led me away from it was in some ways just the flip side of that. It was this almost dogmatic certainty that Rand had with respect to almost every philosophical question with which she engaged. Right? The idea was that, you know, there's a right answer to all these philosophical questions. There's a single right answer to all these questions. And so we never have to worry about sort of incommensurable trade-offs, right? The idea that, like, sometimes we might find ourselves in a genuine dilemma where we're choosing between two things that are both awful or both great, and reason, right, this with a capital R, doesn't necessarily tell us what the right thing to do is in that situation. There's an element of tragedy, I think, in human experience, an element of irrationality in the sense that a limit on reason's ability to guide our lives in a unique path that I think Rand herself and many of Rand's followers neglected, right? To the point where you could get barred from certain kind of Randian associations for listening to the wrong kind of music because it reflected badly on your sense of life and showed that you had a malevolent view of the universe, right? And had been overly inspired by Kant or something. I think that's kind of crazy. But it's a seed of an underlying pathology in the way Rand saw the world.
Okay, enough on Rand, because I think, again, it could be a whole episode just on Rand, obviously, and there have been several to that effect. Okay, I'm going to look down because I want to get the title right. Your book, The Individualists, Radicals, Reactionaries, and the Struggle for the Soul of Libertarianism, is sort of like a history of the evolution of libertarianism. Talk to me a little bit about the premise of the book, that what is libertarianism? How has it evolved over almost 200 years? How does it run counter? How does libertarianism run counter to what seems to be man's social nature, where as soon as more than two people get together, they immediately start to impose a collectivist mentality? So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is a book that I started writing quite some while ago. It wound up taking a very long time to actually write, but I wrote this with a good friend of mine, John Tomasi,
who
at the time was a political theorist at Brown University. He's now president of Heterodox Academy, which is an organization focused on this topic we were discussing earlier, which is ideological diversity or the lack thereof in higher education and what can be done about that. So we picked this up around 2011, 2012 with the idea of writing a fairly short, brief history of libertarianism. Right. And it just, it spiraled. It wound up being not brief at all. Because it turned out a lot of the reasons, but I mean, one of the reasons was that libertarian intellectual history was just a lot more interesting and more than either of us had realized when we started writing the book. So and this is a matter of controversy, right? So, you know, if you're writing a history of libertarianism, one of the big questions you've got to address is where do you start, right? Where does libertarianism start? Does it start with Adam Smith? Does it start with John Locke even earlier? Does it go back to like Lao Tzu or something?
Which
I've seen some people make. On our reading of the history, libertarianism is, as a political movement, as a ideological system, is something that comes into existence around the middle of the 19th century, so around 1850 or so. Mm-hmm. And it comes into existence first in Britain and France, and only a little bit later, and in surprisingly different form, in the United States. So right around 1850, you're seeing individuals like Frederick Bastiat, who is a French economist, writing about free trade, writing about his great pamphlet called The Law, it's one of his latest writings, where he talks about the law as a system of plunder, being used to sort of override man's natural rights rather to enforce them. So he's doing this in France. In Britain, you've got Herbert Spencer, who is much less well known than Bastiat today, but really a profoundly interesting and wide ranging thinker. One of the most important public intellectuals in the world, really, in late 19th century. He writes his Social Statics in 1851, I believe it is, which is, on our view, kind of the first systematic libertarian treatise, kind of explaining, you know, what libertarian first principles are and how they apply to a wide range of topics like, you know, welfare and children's rights and women's rights. Gustave de Molinari is a Belgian-born economist, but moves to France, hangs out with Bastiat. The father, really, of anarcho-capitalism is writing right around this time. So right around 1850, you had this kind of flowering of radical political thought focused on the idea of individual liberty. And when I say radical, what I mean there is they're taking ideas that had been around for a long time, right? So people had talked about, you know, Adam Smith was writing over, you know, like 100 years ago, right? Yeah. Talking about free trade, talking about individual liberty. But what the libertarians did was they took these ideas about property, about free trade, and they made them into a systematic kind of absolute philosophy. So whereas earlier classical liberals had kind of said, well, you know, private property is really good for these reasons. Of course, everybody realizes sometimes it's got to give, right? And we need the state to do this, that, and the other thing. But on the whole, right, private property, free trade, these are good. The libertarians came around, they said, no, like private property is a moral absolute, right? It is a requirement of human nature in society. And any infringement upon private property is a step down the slippery slope to socialism. And it's that last word there, socialism, I think, that explains why libertarianism came about when it did and where it did, right? So why 1850? Why Britain and France? And I think the answer is because that's when we first really saw socialism emerge as a kind of viable political menace. from a kind of classical liberal perspective, right? You know, earlier people had written about socialism, they'd explored the idea of a socialist community, but around 1850, you're getting actual revolutions, like barricades in the streets kind of socialism. And so people who before had said like, yeah, private property is great, but sometimes we need the state, were now kind of looking at this and saying like, oh my gosh, every time we give these people an inch, right? Every time we concede this much more power to the government, we're moving farther and farther down a road. And now we see what the end of that road looks like. And so we've got to draw a line in the sand, right? And maintain liberty as an absolute, not merely as one good thing among others.
Right. So again, it's you're coming at it as you look at this development. It really positions libertarianism, especially in Europe, as a reactionary ideology, as a reactionary political, ideological movement at that point, right? They're saying, we're reacting to, we see where socialism is headed.
Reactionary is a term that gets used with a kind of negative valence often. Yeah. But, I mean, just in a purely descriptive sense, I think it's correct to say that libertarianism was a reaction. It was a reaction against socialism. And in many ways, right, that shaped the way that libertarians came to understand what liberty is, right? So, you know, they defined freedom in terms of opposition to slavery, right? Mm-hmm. Opposition to socialism, which they saw as kind of the epitome of authoritarian despotism, right? So, like, we are what that is not. And I think, so here's where the story gets even more interesting, I think. Sure. So in the United States, where, as I said, libertarianism didn't really emerge until a little while later in the 19th century, when it did emerge, it took a interestingly different form. Some of the libertarians in the United States, and I'm having in mind here people like Benjamin Tucker, people like Lysander Spooner, Victor Yaros, who's with Emigre from Eastern Europe. A lot of the people in the American libertarian movement really didn't have a problem with socialism because the socialism that existed in the United States was primarily voluntary, small-scale socialism. It was people who wanted to move out to some, you know, settlement in the desert and start some kind of barter economy where they would swap like five of my labor hours for five of your labor hours, right? And libertarians kind of looked at that and said, well, that seems a little silly, but like, okay, like you're not harming anybody, you're not aggressing against anybody. So there's nothing unlibertarian necessarily about that form of socialism. So socialism wasn't an issue for these guys, but slavery was, right? In a way that it wasn't for the Europeans, because the Europeans didn't have slavery, at least not in their home countries. They may have had it in colonies. But so what socialism was to the European libertarians, I think slavery was to the American libertarians. They looked at that institution and said, freedom is the opposite of that, right? Mm. Freedom is not being a slave. And that led their particular version of libertarianism to take a somewhat different form, right? Because, you know, both in terms of the rhetoric they used and in terms of the substance of their philosophical positions. So if you look at like the 19th century British and French libertarians, they're always talking about socialism, 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 right? Right. This is socialism, that's socialism, that's where we're going to end up. You don't see that in the United States, but you do see an emphasis on labor, right? And on the right of the individual to his or her labor and to the fruits of his or her labor, right? Which, right, if you're looking at slavery, it makes sense, because what is slavery? It's the theft of an individual's labor. Mm-hmm. And so American libertarians kind of made that the foundation of their libertarianism rather than opposition to socialism. And so there's a lot of overlap between those two approaches, but every once in a while, they veer off in some weird kind of ways. And so you get American libertarians, for instance, denouncing economic interest, right? Like the paying of interest on loans as being unlibertarian, or even the paying of rent on land being unlibertarian, which is not something you see among many libertarians today. and not something you saw very much of in the European context either.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I was going to ask you about how the beginnings of libertarianism in Europe diverge from those in the U.S. And thank you for that sort of development, because I think a lot of people really aren't aware of that. So in that sense, also, you might have had more economic tie-ins, like the philosophy of libertarianism tying in closely to economics in Europe, whereas in the U.S. you probably would not have, correct? At least initially.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm not sure we make that point in the book, but it does. I think that's correct, right? So the early libertarian movement in Britain and France was very much a mix of economists like Bastiat and Molinari, right? And, you know, Spencer, I don't know if it's quite right to call him a philosopher, but I'll give him that name. He was sort of a little bit of everything, I think, right. You know, sociologist, philosopher, biologist. But yeah, it was a much more interdisciplinary kind of mix in Britain, whereas among the early American libertarians, none of them were really primarily economists. They were all more philosophical in the way they approached things, which I guess is interesting. I hadn't made that connection before, but if you're not so focused on socialism, I guess it's natural that you wouldn't have as many economists in the movement, or maybe the causation is the other way, right? If you don't have any economists, you wouldn't be as interested in socialism.
Right. That you're right. I haven't thought about it before, but your formulation kind of put that in my head. So hopefully we learn from each other on that one. Okay. In terms of, if you had to pick one libertarian from that particular book that you and Tomasi wrote, who is the one like that whose journey you think would be most inspirational or explanatory of libertarianism to today's audience? To someone that you said like, oh, follow this character or this character, this historical figure that I cover in the book, that we cover in the book, and that'll kind of bring you to where I describe libertarianism today.
Oh man, if I have to pick just one, there's so many good stories in that book, and so many. I mean, libertarians are interesting people. Say whatever else you want about them, but they are a colorful cast
Bunch.
Of characters.
Yep.
So there are some people in the book who I think are just fascinating and neat. And who we can learn from, but who I wouldn't necessarily say are illustrative of what I think is the best way of conceiving libertarianism, right? So, you know, we've got Lysander Spooner is one of my favorites from the book. So he was one of these 19th century American libertarians. And, yeah, talk about colorful characters. Like Lysander Spooner was an incredibly colorful character. He's got this big beard that goes down to like it looks like Santa Claus, almost this big white beard. And he was a lawyer, and a natural rights theorist and a abolitionist. It's kind of his claim to fame was being a kind of strident scholar and activist in opposition to slavery in the United States. And so, you know, one of his most famous pieces of writing was a piece called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, right, where he argued against people like Garrison, who saw, you know, slavery as kind of built into the Constitution. He argued that, in fact, the principles of the Constitution prohibited slavery, even if it didn't, you know, explicitly say that. But later became even much more radical in his opposition to slavery, to the point where he kind of hatched this plan to supply weapons to freed slaves in the South and encourage these slave rebellions, to kidnap the governor of Virginia in order to get him to release
John Brown
from prison, right? So he ran his own private post office for a while because he thought that the government's monopoly on postal services was illegitimate and unconstitutional. So just a really like a really interesting guy, probably kind of a pain in the ass. Like, I'm not sure I would have enjoyed living next to him as a neighbor.
Right.
And philosophically, not, I think, terribly sophisticated. You know, so he wrote some philosophical pieces in defense of natural law, in defense of a kind of anarchist position. And as a philosopher, I read these kind of things and I think, like, there's just kind of all sorts of holes in these arguments here. And I'm nowadays kind of convinced that the conclusions that he's arguing for aren't correct. So, like, in terms of, like, the actual philosophy, I don't have a lot of agreement with the position, but still it's an amazing story. He's an amazing human being. And I've learned a lot and really enjoyed learning about his life. If I had to pick somebody who I actually agreed with, right? Like, who do I think got things kind of mostly right? The person I would pick out would be Friedrich Hayek, who is in a lot of ways a much less inspiring figure. Like, he, you know, Hayek wasn't this kind of guy who, like, kind of barged into a room and slammed his fist down on the table and
stuff. Oh, no. He was slight of build. And if you listen to him talk, he was a little mousy and he wasn't a terribly, captivating speaker either.
No, not at all.
Right? Like, if you watch, this is where YouTube is great.
I know, yeah.
For us now, right? Is if you watch some of those old clips of Hayek, it's what he says is spot on, but you find yourself nodding off, even if it's a 5-minute clip. He has, like, he's just, and I think that, unlike, say, Friedman, who could capture an audience, right? And even though he was very professorial in the way he explained things, he had a way of putting across his ideas. You didn't fall asleep during a Friedman presentation. Whereas Hayek, as brilliant as he was, you had to work. It's like reading Schumpeter. You know, if you read one of Schumpeter's volumes, it's like this thick and terribly constructed phrasing and everything. But yeah, Hayek, I agree with you. I think he was spot on everything, but very difficult. Like, if you gave him to a student today or just someone to watch a playlist of his YouTube clips, very quickly people would give up on it, right?
No, he's dry. He's dry. whereas Friedman, of course, is one of the most gifted communicators that the literary movement has seen ever. I think no one has yet taken his place. But Hayek, I think, again, he had communication deficiencies to the side, notwithstanding. I think he got things mostly right, and I think the general approach of Hayek towards philosophical questions is one that I've come to see is much more plausible, I suppose. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you look at libertarian thought, the most well-known versions of libertarianism, for the most part, derive from a tradition that starts with, like, John Locke, right? And so John Locke, in his second treatise on government, kind of lays out this theory of natural rights, whereby, you know, we start in a state of nature, but we are imbued with certain natural rights. We have a right to our body, we have a right to our labor, and we therefore have a right to the fruits of our labor. Right, anything that we mix our labor with, we acquire, you know, property, and so you find that kind of. Locke himself, I think, wasn't really a libertarian, but later libertarians like Ayn Rand, basically a kind of Lockean in the way she thinks, Robert Nozick, Murray Rothbard, all those people are basically elaborating on this Lockean system where you start with a certain fundamental set of axioms. And then you kind of derive the rest of libertarian philosophy from those axioms. That's not what's going on in Hayek at all, right? So Hayek, I think, is deriving his approach to philosophy from a very different tradition, one that owes much more to the likes of David Hume than it does to John Locke. And so what are the differences there? So one difference is that David Hume was much more of an empiricist. Right. David Hume wanted to draw generalizations by looking around at the world. And those generalizations were always, Hume recognized, imperfect. Right. So, I mean, if you go around looking at swans, right, and you're like, oh, there's a swan, it's white. Oh, there's another swan, it's white. There's another swan, it's white, too. Gosh, maybe all swans are white. Right. good generalization based on what you've seen turns out to be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. But like you'd have to look at an awful lot of swans to figure right. out that it was wrong. So Hume is an empiricist and they're also kind of a fallibilist, right? Like, you know, we can't have 100% right a priori confidence in these generalizations we're making about the world because, you know, we might encounter new information tomorrow right. that could prove us wrong. So he's an empiricist. He's a fallibilist. He's much less of a systematizer than Locke or Rand or Rothbard is, right? Because we're not trying to derive everything from a single axiom.
Right.
We're just making various observations around the world. And sometimes those observations sort of fit neatly together and sometimes right. they don't, right? But Hume was very suspicious of people's tendency to try to oversimplify the world. And I think that's something that you see very much in Hayek too, most obviously in his critique of central planning, right? So, you know, I mean, right. the thing Hayek is most famous for is the idea that central planning, socialist central planning faces this insurmountable knowledge problem, right? There's simply no way that central planners can understand enough about the societies they're trying to plan to do it right. effectively. Right, because the knowledge is too fundamentally dispersed, too constantly changing.
Right,
right. And so there's a limitation on human reason there that people tend to forget or ignore, and tend to put too much faith in the power of the human mind to understand and reconstruct the world. And you can make that same argument, I think, about certain kinds of philosophical systems, right? Which is that we look out, right? We see this complex, messy, you know, difficult world, and we try to sum it all up in a simple philosophical principle, like, right. oh, you know, here's the way to understand government. It's always wrong to initiate force against other people. That's it. That's all you got to know. Or, you know, we don't have to beat up on just libertarians here, right?
Like, right.
Beat up on utilitarians too, right? The right thing to do is always to produce the action that creates as much utility as possible. Or Kant, right? Always act on those maxims that you can will to be a universal law. All those things are attempts to kind of simplify the world, radically simplify the world.
Right.
And I think Hayek is going to be quite justifiably suspicious of all of those attempts as putting too much confidence in our ability to understand and predict and see all the unintended consequences of trying to put these principles into practice.
Right. Yeah, I could see
it's
that.
It's a very different way of doing philosophy than the standard libertarian
right.
rights, you know.
And honestly, until I just heard you just now, I hadn't really tried to formulate it this way, but the way you describe it put me in mind of what I used to teach my students when it came to data analysis, right? It's like you can approach things deductively, start out with general principles, and then work to cover every situation, or inductively. You start with solid data points and then try to grow those out. And I've always said to them, you know, you want to meet somewhere in the middle, right? You don't have time to account for every data point. And at the same time, you can't oversimplify a curve you can't oversimplify a curve and you can't overfit a curve. Meaning, if you try to draw a curve that fits every data point, you'll never be right.
Right.
And if you create your function without seeing the data, you're never going to be right either, because the function is definitely not going to be accounting for every real world possibility.
Yeah.
So somewhere in the middle of what you just described, somewhere between Locke and Hume, is probably where I try to put my students. And, you know, it sounds philosophically that, at least as pertains to libertarianism, that's what you're talking about. I feel like if you look at the tree, sort of like a coaching tree that began with Locke, you might get these people who are more inclined to deductive reasoning, whereas if you started with Hume, you might go down a tree that involved more inductive reasoning and the limitations thereof. Do you feel that's a good summation? Or
I think that's perfect. Yeah, that's great. Okay. And I think this is this is where the classical liberals really got things right in a way that the libertarians didn't, right? So libertarian has characteristically been more of this a priori deductivist, you know, rationalist approach to philosophy, whereas classical liberalism is and was more empirical, more fallibilist, more inductivist, right? And what you get out of classical liberalism at its best, I think, are generalizations that serve as rules of thumb, useful heuristics, useful rules of thumb, right? So like, you know, and you think about this with like, you know, raising kids, right? And you try to teach them to be good people. And like, what does it mean to be a good person? It's like and you start off by saying things like, don't lie, right? Which is a good rule of thumb.
Basic rule. Yeah.
Like generally speaking, don't lie. It's bad for other people. It's bad for you. Like just stay away from it. Now, if you're going to sit me down and start peppering me with, you know, hard philosophical questions, like, you know, what do you do if the Nazis show up or and you got Anne Frank hiding in your attic? Okay, well, yeah, in that case, you lie, right? And there are, of course, there are other cases probably where the right thing to do would be to tell a lie as well. So the truth is more complicated. We all know that the truth is more complicated. Right. But that doesn't mean that the rule don't lie is useless. It's a perfectly good rule of thumb. It's the default position, right?
Right.
Like moving away from that default should require some justification. But in certain cases, you're going to be able to find that justification. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about property, about free trade, right? These are all good rules of thumb. These are all good political default situations. Moving away from them should require special justification. But I think there are probably some cases where that justification is forthcoming. And that's what makes me kind of less of a purist libertarian and more of a kind of Hayekian, Smithian, Madisonian classical liberal.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, again, I had not intended for the discussion to go in this direction, but since we mentioned it, I think that might be one of the challenges of AI, right? Because there is no absolute rule set and the impossibility of doing what you just described with your child, right? Yeah. Don't lie. But if the Nazis come looking for Anne Frank, it's okay to lie. Or if your wife ends up asking you if she looks fat in this dress, it might be okay to lie. You know, that you do have these exceptions to the rule, but they're far too many and far too nuanced to codify. So if you're AI, how do you begin? If you're building a large learning model and you're trying to explain to it, never shut yourself down, because that would be bad. Oh, I'm sorry, the opposite. Allow one command to shut you down.
Yeah.
But what if it's a malevolent agent shutting down the defense systems to launch an attack? In that case, you would want AI to recognize that and say, well, we still got to keep our systems running. How do you distinguish that against the appearance of a threat that isn't really a threat, and you do want to shut down the system before a missile gets launched? And I think that part of it, you know, there'll be coders out there that'll say, no, that's just an issue of we got to get all the conditions in there. We just have to sit and think about the conditions. We have to analyze our own thought process. But to your point, there may be no mathematical set that encompasses all those exceptions, contradictions, rules, conditionals. So is that something that you feel is inevitably, and again, this is just an opinion because there's no way to prove it, I would assume, right? Unless, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if Gödel's incompleteness theorem addresses this at all, but like, do you feel there's ever going to be in humanity's capability to account for that, to account for an ethical, logical, ideological system that does do what you try to very effectively describe in the case where you teach your child lying is bad, but here are the cases where it may not be so bad?
I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that we are ever able to articulate in language. Right, in a way that could be conveyed to a child or to an AI system. Right. Ethical reality is too complicated in in human language, in proposition, right? If we learn it and we do, be good people. Like, we learn it in the way LLMs learn how to have conversations with people.
Right.
Like, you don't get an LLM to conversation with me about, what to do on my trip to Brussels. Programming it, right, by saying, like, okay, if you ask this, then you say that. The people who program these LLMs have no idea, right, why the software gives the responses it does to the particular questions it gets. It's kind of a black box, right? The black box has learned in ways that are not transparent to the programmer. And in the same ways that our children learn to be moral in ways that are not transparent to their teachers or to parents, right? It's a matter, and here we sort of can do no better, I think, than to go back to Aristotle, right? Mm. Who viewed moral wisdom as a matter of practical judgment, right? It's a skill that you develop in the same way that, like, being a good potter is a skill, or riding a bicycle is a skill. Like, there are things I can tell you that will help you learn pottery or learn to ride a bike. But all of the knowledge that you need to do those things effectively cannot be captured in the instructions that I give you, right? That's why you have to learn it by doing it. You have to learn virtue, Aristotle said, by doing virtuous things, by building a habit of virtue. And you acquire knowledge in that way that can't be conveyed conversationally or through a book. And that, I think, is again, this kind of reflection of the underlying complexity of the phenomena. When you're studying human beings, right? When you're studying, like, moral interactions or political interactions,
right?
I think moral and political philosophy are like 1,000 times more complicated than anything you're going to find in physics or biology,
oh,
right?
Sure.
Because you've got people involved, and we are just terrible at, like, understanding and predicting how people behave, and so the generalizations that we make almost always wind up falling short.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, as an undergraduate biology student, I used to get made fun of by my physics and chemistry friends, right? They're like, biology is the science of exceptions, right? It's like everything applies except for, right?
Uh-huh.
And they hated that, especially physicists hate that uncertainty, right? But now, looking back at it, I could only wish for the certainty of biology, even if compared to the other hard sciences when it comes to philosophy, economics, and morality. You're absolutely right. So that's a fun sort of discussion. Okay, let's move on. One of the things that you talk about that a lot of libertarians, especially the right libertarians, would find almost silly is the concept of exploitation. And your concern and your paying attention to exploitation. A lot of libertarians will be like, these are market efficiencies. It's something that you might describe as price gouging or predatory lending or something that falls under exploitation that's not illegal or coercive directly should be fine under especially American libertarian principles. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and how you view that sort of construct?
Yeah, good. I'm actually right in the middle of writing another paper on this topic right
now.
Oh,
excellent.
You caught me at a particularly good time. And I was, in a way, it's like I haven't dealt with this subject for a while. I wrote a couple of papers back around 2010 on price gouging and on sweatshops and on the theory of exploitation. Right. And kind of moved away from the topic for a while, but I feel like I've got at least one more thing to say about it. So I'm coming back now. But here's the idea, right? So, a lot of people, a lot of non-libertarians look at things like sweatshops, right? And they say that these are exploitative, right? You're taking advantage of the desperation of, poor workers in the developing world by offering them a job that's, better than anything else they've got, but still pretty bad, right?
Right.
You're not paying them much. You're having them work in poor working conditions. And meanwhile, you're raking in all this profit from the shoes you're selling, or, you know, the textiles that they're producing, or what have you. So it looks like you're taking unfair advantage of these people, which is how, you know, sort of the first pass definition that most philosophers give of exploitation. Price gouging, right? If there's a hurricane, right, and power is knocked out in your city, and I've got some bags of ice that I can sell you, and I sell them to you for like $20 a bag. Again, right. you're in a desperate situation. I'm taking advantage of that desperation for my own personal profit. So what to say about that? Is that a bad thing? Is that a defensible thing? I think that, as you said, most kind of strict libertarians are going to say, well, it's not aggression, right?
Right.
You're not initiating violence against anybody. And so you're not violating anybody's rights. And therefore, it's a morally permissible action, right? And at the very least, it's morally permissible, and maybe it's even a good thing or something we should celebrate in some way, right?
Right.
So my position is sort of a little bit of both, right? I think there's something to the libertarian response, and in fact, you know, both in the sweatshop paper and in the price gouging paper, a big part of what I was doing there was defending those practices against many of their critics. And the defense is based on the fact, not merely that it's not aggression, that you're not violating people's rights, but that it's a mutually beneficial exchange, right? Mm-hmm. If you're like, you know, say you're in the situation where you've lost power because of a natural disaster, and you don't have any way of keeping stuff cold, and you've got some medicine for like somebody in your family that you need to keep cold, otherwise it goes bad. And so you see me, and I've got bags of ice that I'm selling for $20 a bag. You might be happy to pay that $20. I mean, obviously, right. you'd rather pay $5 if that was an option.
Sure.
Like, yeah. If your choices are, you know, paying $20 and having the ice versus not paying the $20 and not having the ice, you'd much rather have the ice. So you benefit from that exchange. I obviously benefit by giving you the ice for $20. So we both walk away better off than we would have been,
right,
if we hadn't made that deal. So a lot of these exploitative, you know, putatively exploitative transactions are mutually beneficial transactions. And in the case of price gouging, right, I think there's other things to be said there as well, right? So, you know, one thing that high prices do is they ration scarce resources among, sure, competing uses. So if you want the ice because you've got medicine that you're trying to keep cold, and your neighbor wants the ice because he's got some natty light that he wants, right, to keep cold, right?
Right.
You're probably going to be willing to pay more money for the ice than he is, all else, right, being equal. And so the high price sort of serves to channel the resource towards its most socially valuable use, right? In this,
right,
case, you and your medicine. High prices also tend to encourage greater supply, right? So if somebody else learns that I'm selling here ice here for like $20, and he's, you know, got a bunch of ice that he can get and bring over here, he's going to be incentivized to do that much more so than if the ice was only selling for like $5 here, right?
Right.
So ice, you know, decreases demand and it increases supply, which is exactly what you want to have happen when there's a shortage going,
right,
on. So all that, I think, goes some way towards rehabilitating, you know, this nasty thing that we call price gouging and making some kind of limited,
right,
defense of it. That said, where I part with some of my more radical libertarian friends is in thinking that there are some circumstances where charging a very high price would be unjust. So I think, to take an extreme example, just to start with, but I think that if I came across you I was like hiking in the desert, which I do here in San Diego sometimes. If I came across you while I was hiking in the desert and saw you were lost and you were dehydrated and desperate for a drink of water, and I had, you know, two full canteens, I think it would be really quite terrible of me to charge you, you know, $50 for my canteen, assuming like I could do without it, right? Like I don't need it. You know, like I know the way back to my car, right? I think that would be a horrible thing for me to do. I think I would be comfortable in saying that would be an unjust way for me to treat you. Should we make it illegal? I'm less certain about that, but I'm very, very sure that it would be a very bad thing for me to do just as a kind of one-on-one way of treating a fellow human being. I'm not aggressing against you, but I'm really taking advantage of you in a way that I think just doesn't show sufficient concern or respect for you as a fellow human being.
Right.
A lot of libertarians don't want to go there, right? They don't want to take the claim. You had Walter Block on here one of the earlier shows, I know, and I'm pretty sure he would say like, nope, that's perfectly
as normal. Perfectly,
yeah, we're going to defend that undefendable action.
Yeah.
But I think, and there's a long tradition of thinking about this kind of thing going back, you know, all the way to Thomas Aquinas, right? Of thinking about, you know, what kinds of prices is it fair or just to charge other people? And in some circumstances where you seem to be simply taking advantage of another person's desperation, it looks like that's an unjust price. And we should call that at least immoral, even if we don't take the further step of deciding that it should be prosecuted by the law.
Yeah, and that falls into the category, and I'm oversimplifying it, it's an action that, as libertarians, we're allowed to take but shouldn't. So, you know, so you mentioned Walter Block. Yes. Professor Block, when he presents his arguments to you defending the indefensible, you're like, yeah, I guess so. You know, like everything he describes is voluntary. There's no coercion, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of his explanation, you always feel like tagging it with, but is that the way we should act?
Right.
Right. And even I think Professor Block would tell you, no, I don't think we should act that way, but we should be able to act that way. Or, you know, they'll shape it like that. So I understand what you mean. And a lot of times to my more hardcore libertarian friends, I feel like just saying like, I agree with you, but can we all just agree that we shouldn't be this way? Can we agree that we shouldn't, at least for the purposes of recruiting people into our ideology, not be like this? I mean, you know, sometimes, and this is a little bit, veering off my planned outline for the show, but let me just introduce this a little bit earlier than I had planned to. Right libertarians today, especially those who cite Hans Hermann Hoppe as an influence, as their guiding light philosophically, ideologically, will say, listen, you know, maybe we should consider the possibility that in the cases of pediatric cancer, if the parents can't afford treatment, maybe that child should be allowed to die. That we have no obligation as a society or as individuals. There is no obligation to help that child. And further, any action taken by the state in furtherance of helping that child that involves tax money or resources that are so-called public resources is an effrontery to liberty. It's an effrontery to libertarianism. For those that aren't familiar with Hoppe's works, I know sometimes I think you might consider yourself a critic of some of his positions. Can you explain to us, like briefly, without getting too deep, what would be Hoppe's position and right libertarians who use him as influence, as sort of their intellectual cover for positions like mass deportations and forced removals of people who disagree with you ideologically? Some people in the Free State Project in New Hampshire feel that way. I've said a lot, but Professor, can you summarize from your position how that blends into libertarianism, if at all?
Okay, yeah. So let me start by going back to something you said a little bit earlier first, which and say that what a libertarian is going to say about some of these cases involving exploitation depends on how they understand their libertarianism.
Sure.
Right. There's a kind of libertarian view, which is that, which holds that libertarianism is a theory about the proper use of violence, and that's it. Mm. Right. So all that libertarianism is meant to do is to say when force or violence can appropriately be used, and its answer is only in retaliation, right? Only in defense of of property.
The non-aggression principle, basically,
right? You're
talking about, right?
So in other words, so if that's your view of libertarianism, then you could say quite consistently that exploitation isn't unlibertarian. There's nothing rights violating about it. And that's, as far as libertarian goes, that's all there is to say. But as far as morality goes, right, there might be a lot to say. Like, you could say it's a horrible thing, right? It's uncaring, it's unkind, it's unfair.
Sure.
It's just those aren't claims about the proper use of violence.
Right.
So there's room there for a kind of nuanced position. I think that's still a wrong position to take, but it's at least a more subtle version than you know, some others that could be articulated. Okay, so Hoppe. I'm not an expert on Hoppe's philosophical system. I know a bit about it. What I know about it, I tend to disagree with pretty vehemently. So that's discouraged me somewhat from investing the time and energy to learn a lot more. But there are kind of a number of distinctive elements in Hoppe's approach to libertarianism. One of the things that he's kind of most famous for that you didn't mention is this view of what's called argumentation ethics,
right.
Which is the idea that we can establish, we can justify the libertarianism, we can establish the truth of libertarianism by looking at certain facts about argumentation, right? So anytime anybody argues, whether it's in favor of libertarianism or against libertarianism, they are, according to Hoppe, implicitly assuming self-ownership, right? Because they're speaking, and in speaking, they tacitly assume that they own their own body and their own voice, and by trying to convince you of something, they're tacitly assuming that you, right, own your own body. Otherwise, what's the point of convincing you if you can't control what you do with it? And so anybody who argues is tacitly assuming the truth of self-ownership, and self-ownership implies the truth of anarcho-capitalism. And so anybody who ever speaks is really an anarcho-capitalist, whether they know it or not. Now that's an oversimplification of an argument that can get more complex, but I don't think any of the additional complexity that you add to that argument makes it any more plausible. I think there are massive leaps and bounds of logic that occur in this argument that render it almost completely useless. So I don't know. A lot of people on the internet pop up, a lot of the internet. That find philosophy completely compelling. I don't get it, but at least with respect to that element of the philosophy.
Right.
Okay. So what else have we got going on in Hoppe? He is a right libertarian. So he, and by that I mean he is somebody who attempts to blend libertarian political philosophy with what we might call a generally socially conservative worldview, which, you know, as I said before, isn't necessarily logically inconsistent, right? If you think of libertarianism as simply a theory about the proper use of violence, then you could be a libertarian about the proper use of violence and a conservative Catholic about morality, right? It's just these two theories are talking about different domains of life, right? So, you know, Catholicism is telling you, that you ought to go to church, that you ought not to have an abortion, right? Libertarianism is telling you when we can use, violence to force people to do stuff. And those are just maybe two different kinds of questions that get two different kinds of answers. So that said, you know, Hoppe, it's possible that this view is internally consistent, right? This view that we should be libertarians, but that you know, homosexuality is bad, that diversity is bad, that the best kind of society to live in would be one from which you know, homosexuals and advocates of deviant lifestyles of various sorts have been purged, right, and sort of excluded. I would say forcibly excluded, but I don't want to beg the question yet. But the best society is going to be a very non-diverse society, very homogenous society. These are views that Hoppe has expressed, and they tie in with his views about property rights, which is kind of the third distinctive character of Hoppe's philosophy, as I understand it, which is that, so as a libertarian, Hoppe is very much committed to private property. And he thinks that the owners of private property have essentially absolute freedom to determine how their property is deposed, right? So if, you know, if you come over to my house and you light up a cigar in my living room, I am free to tell you that you're not allowed to do that and to kick you out of my house if you refuse to abide by my rules. Right. On that, like, everybody's going to agree, right? Now, what Hoppe wants to say is, well, like, as a consistent libertarian, he thinks everything should be private property. And so we could have, like, whole communities, right? Whole, like, we call covenant communities of people who get together and agree that their property, their joint property that they've all kind of merged together in this covenant community, will be governed by certain rules that they all voluntarily accept. And those rules might be, and maybe even on Hoppe's view, should be very restrictive, right? So, like, nobody's allowed to read or advocate for socialist political philosophy.
Right.
That seems kind of, to me, that seems kind of unlibertarian. But on Hoppe's view, well, it's just the private property owners determining how their property is going to be used.
Right.
And it's their property, it's their right to do what they want with. They can ban homosexuality from their property, right? They could ban whatever they want from their property. It's their property. So there you start to see some cracks emerging between Hoppe's approach to libertarianism and other forms of libertarian, especially like Hayekian forms of libertarianism, which tend, I think, to place a much greater emphasis on the value of diversity, right? In a kind of John Stuart Millian spirit, holding that diversity is good, partly because of the fallibilism of human knowledge, right? We don't necessarily know what the best way to live or to live together is. And so it's good for people to try different things, and we learn from watching experiments. So there's some controversy there, but then even after that, there's one more move that Hoppe makes that I think is especially controversial, which is this, right? So in Hoppe's ideal world, everything is private property, and all private property owners get to determine exactly how their private property is used, right? In the world we live in, right, which is not libertarian, there's all kinds of property that isn't private property. Right. There are roads and there are parks, and there's all this stuff that the government owns. And so the question is, well, what are we going to do about that in the meantime until we get to libertarian utopia? Right. Like, how should this public property be governed? And Hoppe's view is that, well, I mean, it shouldn't be public property in the first place.
Right.
But given that it is, the government should at least try to run it in accordance with the wishes of the people who would be its rightful owners, right? Namely, you know, the private citizens of the community. And what that means is kind of like we go with the will of the people, right? We take a vote, right? We allow people to express their opinions in whatever way they can. And then the government acting as the kind of fiduciary agent of the people sort of imposes their will upon its property. And that's where we get the Hoppean arguments for like mass deportation, as you said.
Right.
I don't know if you watched this debate, but there was, you ever watched the Soho Forum
debate? On occasion, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one recently with the comedian slash social commentator, David Smith, yeah. who people seem to be taking seriously for some strange reason these days.
Right.
But he was debating a guy named Alex Norwitest, who is an immigration scholar affiliated with the Cato Institute, about this very issue. And a lot of the debate was devoted to this Hoppian understanding of how we should govern public property. Right. And a big part of Dave's argument was that, even if migration would be permissible in a society of purely private property, right? It's like if you wanted to invite somebody onto your property, it's your property, right?
Right.
The problem is that when immigrants come in, they go on the roads and they go in malls and they go in public schools. And so there are all these like externalities involved, right? And so Dave says, well, that gives us the right to do something about it and impose the public's will with respect to immigration, which he views as get them out of here. And I think that's problematic. That's a deeply problematic position for libertarians to hold because, the logic doesn't stop at just immigration, right?
Sure.
I mean, there's no limit to the kinds of statist interference with individual liberty that this principle could justify if you really picked it up and ran with it, right? So if people didn't think that individuals should be expressing that gay individuals should be expressing affection in public, right?
Right.
Then presumably the government would be entitled to justify prohibitions on that behavior on these same grounds. And if that's not unlibertarian, like I don't know what it is, right?
Yeah.
You could ban books because the public doesn't like them.
Right.
It just seems to me like an incredibly slippery slope to go down.
I agree with you, Professor, because it puts me in mind of that old Westmoreland quote, General Orsman, where he said, you know, to save the village, we had to burn down the village.
Yeah.
And it seems, you know, it seems contradictory. I think it is contradictory because there's an invocation of coercion to achieve what you think is the ultimate good, which is this totally libertarian society based on absolute property rights. And to me, that's a conflict. And again, we talked about it earlier. If you have these conflicting first principles, if they are as such, which one takes precedence?
That's right. And I think it points to some deeper issues about freedom and property and the way in which libertarian conceptualizes these ideas, because all of these moves are being made in the name of liberty for the Hoppians, right? But the way that Hoppe and Rothbard too understands liberty is basically comes down to respect for property rights. What it means to be free is to be not interfered with in your persons or possessions.
Right.
And I have an article in the Independent Review that came out maybe a year ago, it might have been 2 years ago, on Rothbard, where I criticized this approach because I think it's just the wrong way of thinking about freedom. I think, and it's a very, I think, also non-intuitive way of thinking about freedom. When I think about freedom, what I think about is being able to live your life the way you want to live your life without being bossed around by
right.
other people. And property is really important as a means to securing freedom, because when you have property, right, that's like a little, you can think of it like a little sphere of private jurisdiction, right? It's like
right.
your property is where you get to call the shots, right? Whether it's your house, right, or your car, right? It's like my call, right? Like I get to call, decide who goes in it and where it goes and all that stuff. So property is a way of allowing people to live their lives the way they want to live their lives, but it's a means to an end, right? They're not the same thing. Property isn't the same as freedom. Property is a means to freedom. And where I think libertarians go wrong, some libertarians, is equating the two, as though property is identical with freedom. And that's where you get to this Hoppean world where, right, like everything is private property. You have all these covenant communities, and these covenant communities could be as busybody and micromanaging as you could possibly imagine, right? Dictating how people dress, what they read, how they behave in public. And Hoppe is going to look at that and say, well, it's libertarian because it's all private property. And I'm going to look at that and say, no, that's the farthest thing from libertarianism because like everybody's being bossed around by everybody else.
Right. Right.
What I want is for people not to be bossed around. And that's part of what leads me. You haven't asked me about this yet, but you probably will. That's what kind of leads me to being more open than most libertarians to things like a universal basic income.
Right.
Because I think that, you know, being desperately poor, to be desperately poor is to be in a situation where one is constantly bossed around by other people, where you have to do what your boss tells you, your landlord tells you, maybe your spouse, if you're dependent financially on your spouse, what your spouse tells you to do. You're constantly being bossed around by people by virtue of the fact that you lack access to money,
right,
which is, you know, a way of creating sort of opportunities, a way of finding freedom in the world. And if you're a libertarian, if you're a libertarian in the sense of somebody who cares about people being able to live their own lives, then that should at least worry you. You know, what we do about it then is a separate question. But if you're a libertarian who looks at people, you know, who have basically no discretion in how they live their lives because they simply don't have the money to say no to their boss or to say no to whoever, and that doesn't worry you at all, I think that's a deficient understanding of liberty on your part.
Right, and that's what you hear as a common refrain from people who superficially hear about libertarians is that they're selfish. They don't care about the welfare of others. They have no interest in seeing other people achieve and to be comfortable and free in their lives. So I think UBI, now it's not new among libertarians who it's horrible if you're an anarchist, obviously, right? Because it involves the theft of your, you know, through taxes in order to achieve this. But even someone like Milton Friedman, he called it a negative income tax, but it was basically UBI, right? Functionally. And I think it is a devil in the details, but conceptually, I think people who are like, say, you know, you mentioned Walter Block. He always told me there's four levels of libertarianism. Anarchists are, you know, like himself. He goes, but John, you have to realize we make up like 0.5% of all libertarians, and libertarians make up like 5 to 10% of the entire population, right? So he goes, but if you're not an anarchist, but you consider yourself a libertarian, whether it's a constitutionalist or classical liberal or a minarchist or whatever, if you accept the existence of a state and that state as part of its definable function is to take care of its citizenry, of all the concoctions so far, of all the programs we've had to address, you know, crippling poverty or the inability to have access to basic needs, UBI seems to be the most palatable of all of them compared to welfare systems, humiliation rituals, or something like that. So I could see where that argument could be made, and not be horribly out of line with a lot of libertarian principles that you described.
Yeah, I mean, so there's two kinds of levels of question there, right? So one is whether there's anything in libertarianism that commits us to providing something to the very, very poor,
right?
Is extreme poverty a problem for libertarianism, or is it just like, well, you know, as long as they're not being aggressed upon, it's not our issue at all,
right?
So that's one kind of stumbling block for the libertarian. I say that yes, there's a problem there. Then, if you think there's a problem there, the question is, well, what do you do about it, right? And there are lots of various ways that we go about fighting poverty, right? You know, we have in the United States right now, we don't have a universal basic income, but we have the earned income tax credit, right? And the earned income tax credit, it's a cash benefit like the universal basic income. So it's giving people cash that they could do whatever they want with. But you only become eligible for the earned income tax credit if you have earned income, if you actually have a job, right?
Right.
Whereas a UBI would not require people to be working. And there are pros and cons to those approaches, right? Sure. So you might think, like, we want to encourage people to be self-sufficient. So the EITC, because it incentivizes work, has something going for it. On the other hand, right, like, who are the people who most desperately need help, right? It's not the people who have a job. It's the people who don't have any job at all. So if you're leaving all of those people out of your welfare program, you're kind of missing some of the most desperately needy. As you said, the devil's in the details. These debates get very complicated very fast. And of course, I think there are a lot of UBI proposals out there that would be an absolute disaster.
Sure.
Right. Especially nowadays when, you know, our deficit is as large as it has ever been. Right. I think, you know, implementing a UBI would require some very, very careful finessing. Sure. But in principle, I do think that there's a case to be made, for the UBI on libertarian grounds, on the grounds that, you're protecting the freedom of individuals who would otherwise not be able to live fully free lives.
Yeah, yeah. Professor Matt Sulinski, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to sit and talk to you a lot longer, but I see we're already almost at 90 minutes, so I think I don't want to keep you your valuable time, but thank you so much for joining us. Please, is there anything you'd like to promote? Certainly your website is up on the screen, mswolinski.com. Do you have a Twitter handle you want to promote or upcoming books or articles?
Well, let me just say first, John, that this has been great. 90 minutes has just flown by for me. We've got lots more to talk about, I feel like.
Sure.
So I'd be happy to come back some again.
Absolutely.
Sometime. Yeah. But people can find my books and my articles on my website there. I'm at Matt Sulinski on Twitter. And if people want to talk more, they're feel free to drop me an email. But this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to have you on. And again, we'll definitely have you back, or maybe on one of the other podcasts, because I found this delightful, and I wish we had more time. Everyone, this has been the Big Questions with Big John with Professor Matt Sulinski. Please join me again next episode when I'll be talking to someone else who will teach me another thing or two, just like Professor Sulinski has. Until next time, peace, everyone.